do what needs to be done. And what that is will have to be determined after the spring. But we certainly haven't been soft on them. And neither have they really dogged it in the cleanup. They've spent $1.2 or $1.3 billion, and the cleanup has been a mammoth effort.
Governor Cooper, perhaps you'd like to step in here. A little earlier, Dennis Kelso, Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, spoke to us and said that he was very concerned that Exxon has yet to allow the state to supervise any cleanup effort that it might get back involved in the spring, and there's still some question as to whether they will even be back. Are you with us, Governor?
I don't know if you can hear us or not, but something happened to the transmission. And
well, Governor, you are on right now. You're on the air.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Did you hear my question?
Parts of it. You might want to repeat it.
Okay. Governor Dennis Kelso has been Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. He said a little bit earlier today that he was concerned that Exxon, if they do come back, and there's a big if there, may not allow the state to supervise any cleanup that they might be doing. Do you have some concerns there?
Well, of course I have some concerns about that. Under the statutory scheme under which we are required to operate, it is not clear what our authority is. We know we have a separate jurisdiction to clean up any mess that's been made within our 3-mile limit, within our waters, but it is not by any means clear that we have the authority to direct Exxon to do anything. That is an issue that needs to be attended to in the U.S. Congress. Somebody needs to be clearly in charge of cleanup efforts like this. Yes, I'm concerned about the extent of our authority over Exxon. I think it's a legitimate concern. It's a part of the law that is now in place, and it needs to be clarified by the Congress.
Excuse me, Governor, we just want to take a minute. We just have a couple of minutes left, and we want to say goodbye right now to Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we've got some callers on from all over the nation, and we just want to let you know what our number is here. It's 800-325-1100.
We have a caller on the line right now from St. Louis. Welcome, St. Louis. You're on the line.
Hello. My name is Jean Brown, and I worked in Alaska as a volunteer this summer in Seward cleaning sea otters. I also had the opportunity to attend MAC meetings where the multi-agency groups got together and talked with the Exxon rep and the Coast Guard about cleanup. And I'm concerned about the system that operated in this cleanup. The state senator talked about the national interest we have, national security interest on importing oil, Alaska being a heavy oil-producing state. The Coast Guard talked about the incredible efforts that Exxon demonstrated, and the governor talked about the inability to oversee Exxon's activity. When I sat in these meetings in July, I saw the Coast Guard support and sympathize with Exxon when state agencies were trying to demand appropriate cleanup activity. And I'm concerned that the focus is on legislation, lower liabilities, and on deciding whether or not the appropriate Exxon chemicals are being used. I don't think the kind of attention is focused on Exxon's attitude and the ability that it has to determine whether or not it will continue to clean and how it will clean in the spring. What is the state senator doing? And what is the governor doing? And what is the administration doing to change the way this system works?
Thank you. Let's give the senator an opportunity to answer.
Well, I'm pleased you're up here to help us. The Senate has already passed a bill that we had a great deal to do with, along with Senator Mitchell of Maine, two states violently opposed to some of the changes were suggested otherwise. We believe that we should change the law. We will change the law so that there is authority for the president to be in charge, so that there is a fund that can make these payments in the event that there's a similar disaster, so that there will be monies available to the state and to local governments immediately so they can start working on a disaster and a disaster recovery plan like this. But basically, we're also trying to make certain we try to get the oil out of the water so it won't ever get to the beaches and harm the otters that you saw. You know, one thing you said, I think you said, and others have been saying, and that is if Exxon comes back next year, Exxon is committed to come back. They've already told the Senate, that the Senate Commerce Committee and the Congress, that they will come back if the Coast Guard believes there's work to be done. And you've heard Admiral Yost, he says it's not done yet. So Exxon will be back.
Thank you, Senator. Our thanks to Senator Ted Stevens and Governor Cooper, who will be back with us in just a bit.
In the 177 days since the Exxon Valdez ran aground, the spilled oil has spread over 11,000 square miles of the water's surface in Alaskan's water. It has now reached so far down the Alaska Peninsula that it's becoming difficult to track. The reconnaissance plane has no place to refuel before it returns to Kodiak. We'll be back in a minute.
This concludes our national look at the Alaska oil spill. We had help from reporters Susan Kernis, Gary Fite, Sue Rapley, Lainey Welch, Joe Gallagher, Charlene Parent, Kelly Law, Peter Kenyon, and John Greeley. Technical assistance was provided by Jeff Brown, WAMU, Jeremy Landsman, the Octagon Company, Larry Yarrow, Ed Clark, and Deanne Hamilton. The teleprompter was provided by Computerland. Our engineer is Diana Derby. Steve Heimel directed the program. The producer is Sue Boris. The producer of our Washington segment is Cindy Johnston. The executive producer is Johanna York. Special thanks to the University of Alaska Anchorage Distance Education Service for telecommunications. The music in today's program was composed by Kurt Riemann. I'm Corey Flintoff.
And I'm Pat Bodner. A nationwide call-in is produced by the Alaska Public Radio Network in partnership with American Public Radio. The Alaska Oil Spill, a nationwide call-in, is made possible by APR and member stations and the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission. The toll-free line, courtesy of Alaska. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
We're back in the Alaska segment of our call-in program. I'm Corey Flintoff.
And I'm Pat Bodner. The number to call here is 800-325-1100. In our studio is Alaska Senior Senator Ted Stevens, and we will also try to reestablish contact with Governor Steve Cooper. But in the meantime, we're here and we're ready to take your calls.
Senator Stevens, you reacted rather strongly earlier on to suggestions that the President Bush hasn't done enough, to suggestions that the administration hasn't done enough. this is your chance, baby.
Well, I think, you know, the thing is that any president has to listen in the final analysis to his legal advisor, the Attorney General. And he was advised that if he federalized this spill and took it over and made it a federal cleanup effort, that would take Exxon at least partially and perhaps totally off the hook because of the inability to prove what would happen in terms of the flow of the oil in a natural condition. You know, once you start a cleanup effort, you might divert oil from one area to another, and it is there is no question that he had that advice. Now, under the circumstance he had that advice, I like to recall for people that the president is commander-in-chief ordered the C-5As to fly any equipment that was found that could be helpful from throughout the world came in here by C-5As. He organized General McInerney's group here in support of the Coast Guard, giving full support of the Department of Defense to the Coast Guard as the on-site commander. He made available troop ships for the people who are going to start the cleanup effort to live on in the beginning. That advanced the time when the cleanup effort started by at least a month. We've had a consistent support of the president through all of the efforts that have been gone forward so far. And I think as commander-in-chief, I can't remember, even in terms of the earthquake, having the kind of total support from the military that he has ordered the military to provide for this effort. Now, you've got to remember, it has to stay all within the umbrella of the decision made by the president's legal advisors that Exxon had to remain in charge, otherwise we could not hold him totally liable. That liability has not been assessed yet. The damage assessment is going on now. There's damages under the Clean Water Act. There's damages under the State Little Clean Water Act. There's damages due to the people who have been harmed, have suffered losses. There's a whole series of additional penalties that then will be assessed against Exxon under provisions of federal criminal law. Now, I think that keeping those in mind, that the president's actions have maximized the recovery and given us as much as possible from the federal government to support it. And we have to remember the one caller was right, Harper. At the time of the accident, this disaster, there was about $6 million in the fund that we could have called on at the time to get this underway. And no one, I don't think anyone would have foreseen that we would have been able to pull up $1 billion so far, $1 billion plus so far in federal money to get these things done that had to be done. Having Exxon in control was absolutely necessary. Should there be another disaster like this, God forbid, as I said before, there will be the $1 billion in the liability fund that can be drawn down upon not only by the federal government, but by the state and by local governments to meet their responsibilities.
Senator, we are going to go to a caller right now. We have a caller coming, talking to us from Cordova. Ricky Ott is from the Cordova District Fishermen United. Ricky, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Do you have a question?
I have a comment and a question, and I guess the comment is relating more to federal legislation, and I'm sorry I missed the national segment, but that's the way it goes. Everyone's heard that, well, first of all, I don't share Senator Stevens' confidence that the Congress will adopt tougher cleanup and compensation laws unless citizens get involved and make this happen. So what we're asking is that all citizens in Alaska call their out-of-state friends and tell them to call their U.S. representatives to insist that no legislation is voted on that preempts states' rights. And we also support higher limits for liability for the spillers. We heard that should the House bills pass, Exxon's liability would have been limited to $49 million, and of course that's pretty ridiculous. We don't want the taxpayers paying for oil industry spills.
That's your comment. We have two guests here, Senator Ted Stevens and Governor Cooper is back on the line with us from Juneau. How about a question, either for the governor or for the senator?
The question is, I guess I'm a little bit confused. Everyone's been referring to international laws, and the only one I'm aware of there are the 1984 protocols, which have come up year after year. And I feel that in light of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, these protocols are obsolete and they need to be renegotiated with the other nations. How does Senator Stevens feel about that? These protocols do preempt states' rights, by the way.
Ricky, I know that's why they've never been acted on, and you've got to recall that was during the time when the
the Republicans control the Senate. We didn't act on them. The Democrats control the Senate. We've not acted on those protocols. They are international protocols. From the point of view of international, however, they increase the liability because they do create a different fund, and they create not only the national fund for each nation, but the international fund, and that's why many people support them throughout the world. That would be greater protection of the oceans throughout the world if the protocols were going into effect. We're trying to find a way to put them in effect without preempting our own local additional liability laws that apply to our waters, and particularly to the transit of our tankers in our waters. So I think it'll be worked out. I don't have any problem with what you're talking about getting people outside the color centers to support, uncolored House members to support the Senate version of the bill. And I believe we will work out a comprehensive oil liability legislation this year. I think we haven't even mentioned the most significant part, and I think you would agree, and that's the prevention side of that bill. That bill requires 7 response teams nationwide. It provides the facilities for training. It provides the alert responsibility to try and see if we can't marshal the forces of the whole country towards any place where there's a major spill like this, so we can try and get the oil out of the water. I think that if you looked at the Senate bill, the most important part of the bill is the prevention side. But I also support the liability side. That was my provision, and I'm pleased with it.
Thank you, Ricky Ott. We have a lot of callers waiting. This is your opportunity to talk to our guests right now. Senator Ted Stevens here with us in Anchorage. Governor Steve Cooper on the line with us from Juneau. The number to call is 1-800-325-1100. Our next caller is from the Chukchi Sea. Welcome. Can you hear us?
Yes. And actually, I'm not calling from the Chukchi Sea, but about it. This is Larry Landrin calling from Northern Alaska Environmental Center in Fairbanks.
That's a little closer.
Yeah, closer to home. I'm calling because the spill opened a lot of people's eyes about the ability of the industry to clean up an oil spill. Well, there's oil drilling going on in other parts of the state. Two of those places are the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea. We think it is very apparent that if they have a spill in any of those areas, they are not going to be able to clean it up. The State Department of Environmental Conservation did an analysis of ability to clean up a spill up there and found exactly that. If there's a big spill, they're going to have serious, serious problems. Yet, the Minerals Management Service, which has authority over offshore drilling, decided that if there was a problem, it'd be absolutely fine. It's sort of a classic response. They are very much friendly with the oil industry and want to help them out whenever they can.
Well, let's make this into a question, and let's direct it to one of the guests. Sir.
It is. The question is to Senator Stevens. I'd like to ask him what he can do to get a little more maybe rational and objective review of the ability of the industry to respond to a spill up there, and to make sure that some real positive and genuine changes are made that are going to be able to deal with the circumstances up there better.
Well, you know, we delayed as long as possible the offshore exploration, particularly in terms of the North Lucian Shelf and the Chukchi Sea, because we thought ANWR was going to go ahead. But you and other people have opposed the drilling onshore, and the nation needs oil. We imported more than 50% of our oil both in January and June. How did you get to work this morning? Did you walk?
I rode a bicycle.
And how did you fly to Anchorage last week? You know, it's a practical matter. We need oil, and you put an impossible burden on us by not allowing to drill onshore.
Well, I guess I'll disagree with that. The offshore leasing was part of the president's wholesale bargain basement giveaway of offshore drilling areas all over the country. But that really begs the question. It has been
a lot of the and you know it, those leases were offered first 10, 12, 14 years ago. As a matter of fact, it was Lyndon Johnson who came out with the whole concept of going forward with leasing the Outer Continental Shelf. As a matter of fact, Harry Truman himself announced the Outer Continental Shelf doctrine. This is not a partisan matter. And you and others have been dumping on the president and me too long.
I guess what I would like to know is that it is happening. I'd like to know how we can take steps to make sure it happens safely and better.
We had a contingency plan review. That's one of the first offshore wells. Exploration has taken place up there, and it was just a drilling barge standing by. That's the first time we have total response capability. They're on scene, ready to handle in the event there was any kind of a spill. There was not. They've drilled a well, and so far as I know, they've filled out now. They're not going to tell us what they hit. They have a right for 2 years to review the of the information they got from that well, and they'll proceed that way. But one of the reasons they are offshore is because you won't let us drill onshore. Don't forget that. We could drill onshore. We could probably bring in billions of barrels of oil and not have to worry about the Chukchi Sea or the North Aleutian Shelf for another generation if we could drill onshore and prove up that oil.
We want to allow some you listeners out there to jump into the fray. The number here is 800-325-1100. And remember that Governor Steve Cooper is also out there if you want to direct your questions to him.
We have another Fairbanks caller on the line. Hello, Fairbanks. You have a question either for Senator Ted Stevens or Governor Steve Cooper?
Well, I do. My name's Lynette Clark. I've been on the spill since the 6th of May in Task Force 1. And I'd like to address this inquiry to both Senator Stevens and Governor Cooper. I'm real concerned. I was involved with the fire remediation team. I'm very concerned about the environmental hazards of it. The team members were tested once every 12 hours for blood in their urine. There's studies that have been done as extensive as far as the kidney and liver damages, and I'm concerned about liabilities down the road for some of these 18, 19-year-old kids that were using this stuff. I don't understand why it was used. It's real dangerous. I'm real curious as to how in the hell it got on our beaches to begin with, besides the oil.
Steve, you want me to go first on that? Part of that's a federal experiment, as you know, the substances were inert, but when they mixed together, they did become active. We were concerned, still are concerned, about the impact on the individuals. We hope that if the system proves workable without doing damage to the marine environment, that it will be possible to put it out without involving individuals to the exposure that you and others may have had along the line. We don't know for certain that what you say is true yet, but there have been, what are the environmental consequences of those that handle it? But the bioremediation concept is something that's been around for a long time. It worked substantially in Norway, and we still have hopes that it may be one of the ways to clean up an oil spill without damage to the water column or the marine resources, and without risk to the people who put it out. It is still something, however. Steve, your people looked at it too. I don't know what you have to say about it.
Yeah, bioremediation is one of those things that we've done that appears to work. As the caller mentioned, there have been some reports of hazards to the people who were actually there when the chemical that's used to fertilize the area is used. We want to be sure that we understand fully what the impact of that is going to be, because if it's bad, we don't want anybody there when we use this stuff. We haven't analyzed that properly yet, but we will do so during the winter. That's one of the things that we absolutely have to do, because this is a promising method of cleaning up the oil. While it is promising, we certainly don't want to use it if it's going to be detrimental to the health of the people who are in the area. It may be possible to require protective clothing of some sort when this is used in the area where there are people. But in any event, we're not going to allow that situation to take place again. And I appreciate Lynette Clark's calling in and bringing that to our attention.
Yeah, thank our caller in Fairbanks for bringing that up. Our next caller is in Wasilla. This is your opportunity to talk to Senator Ted Stevens and Governor Steve Cooper. Welcome, Wasilla. You're on the air.
I'm really concerned about Amarillo Hills using foreign bottoms to ship oil out of Barbados to the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I'd like to know how, when, and why were they granted an exemption to the Jones Act?
Well, they really weren't granted exemption, I don't believe, as much as they are taking oil that goes to another port under the U.S. flag into the Virgin Islands, and therefore they're not going port to port in the United States. I think you should realize that those are owned by an American company, does have an interest in the North Slope, and they do have $1 billion insurance. I was reassured of that just this last week on every one of those tankers, and they've been very responsible. I think that...
that they are not foreign tankers like we normally would refer to foreign tankers that have no connection with the United States. They have been looked out and we continue to make certain about their condition, and I think they're supervised very closely since they come within our waters.
We just need to take a moment right now to thank Alaska Senior Senator Ted Stevens. Thanks for joining us this morning in our studios. We really appreciate you coming by.
Thank you. I think it's wonderful you've done this program, and thank you for doing the one nationwide. I think that's a good way to get information out about what's going on up here. We need a lot more of that. Appreciate it.
Thank you. We also have a caller from Anchorage right now. Caller, are you out there? Well, maybe we'll establish contact with that caller in just a minute. In the meantime, if you'd like to check in with us, talk to Governor Steve Cooper, and participate in this show, our number here is 800-325-1100.
Our guest right now, Governor Steve Cooper, is on the line in Juneau. We'll be bringing on some more guests in just a bit. We do have another caller ready to go. This caller is from Anchorage. Welcome, Anchorage. You're on the air. Whoops. No, you're not. Governor Cooper, while we're waiting for more calls to come in, getting back to the question not only of bioremediation, but some of these other chemical means, they were described, I think, in your winter spill plan as complex chemical means that you did not favor as much as the sort of mechanical cleanup methods. Can you just outline a little bit what you expect your winter research to produce as far as these different technologies, either chemical or mechanical?
Well, as you can imagine, Corey, we had, throughout the period of the spill cleanup, literally hundreds of recommendations and proposals to use various substances, various materials and methodologies to clean up the oil. Some of the methodologies were said to work in the water, others were said to work in the substrate. Now, given the mobilization that had to take place in order to accomplish the cleanup or whatever we did accomplish in this cleanup, you can understand that each and every one of those proposals was not given a fair trial. The calls were made essentially by Exxon as to which methodology to use, and in the meantime, there may be a number of very promising ways to get the oil out of the substrate. In particular, we've had one proposal to use a grid and to sink well points along that grid to drive either hot water or steam or perhaps corrosives or some other chemical into the substrate to effectively force up to the surface the oil which is down there. Is that going to work? We don't know. It's the kind of thing that lends itself to some limited experimentation over the winter to see if it does work or not. These are suggestions that have been made by people who have actually been on scene. We have a lot of other substances that were said to be very helpful. We'll try to test those out as well during the winter. But this gives us a little bit of breathing room in terms of our ability to do a little experimentation and a little research so that when we hit the beaches again next spring, we'll know what works and what doesn't.
Thank you, Governor. We have another caller coming up. This one in Juneau, standing by. This is your opportunity, by the way, to speak to our guest, Governor Steve Cooper, and we'll have some more guests that we'll be bringing in just a moment. Juneau, you're on the line with Governor Steve Cooper. Welcome, and may we have your question?
This was to be directed at Senator Stevens.
Can I ask you to turn down your radio? Unfortunately, Senator Stevens has had to leave, but Governor Cooper is here with us.
Yes. This was to be directed at Senator Stevens, but he's escaped again. Senator Stevens was one of the major factors in getting the oil transportation route to the Marine Lake, and he fought the Trans-Canada deal, and he got very upset a little while ago about being attacked on this thing. Well, if it had gone through Canada, the transportation line had gone through Canada, there wouldn't be all this oil problem, and Prince William Sound would have been protected, and they would have had their drilling and so on and so forth. And of course,
Senator Governor Cooper was here at the time. He knows something about that. But
I can ask you to stay on the line for just a moment. We do have a guest who may be able to speak to the history of the pipeline.
All right.
And we would like to introduce two new guests who are joining us in our studios here in Anchorage. Walt Parker is the chairman of the Alaska Oil Spill Commission. He was appointed by Governor Cooper to investigate the history of the Exxon Valdez grounding and the adequacy of the spill response. We also have here in our studios Roger Herrera, who is with British Petroleum. He's now an executive consultant to the president of BP Exploration here in Alaska. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. And Walt Parker, getting back to the question about the history of the pipeline and the choice to go through Valdez as opposed to an overland route, can you answer the caller's question?
Yeah, actually the Trans-Canada pipeline, while it received a good deal of press attention at that time, never really got very far in the Nixon administration or the Congress. I did a survey. I was transportation planning officer at the Federal Field Committee for Development Planning in Alaska, and did a comparison of the two routes, both environmental and economic, and the only ones who really picked up on that were Senator Hammond, then Senator Hammond in the state Senate, and his colleague Senator Bob Palmer, who showed some interest, very short-lived. And while it received a good deal of attention in examining the environmental impact statement, it really never got off the ground as a serious concept, mainly because the industry didn't particularly want it. If they'd wanted it, it would have probably gone, and the federal government didn't at that time was not enthusiastic about it either.
That was probably the person who covered those events most closely. I was in the legislature at the time, however, and it's my recollection that there were some concerns about the security of running a pipeline that long through another nation. That was certainly a matter that was taken up, and I think it's fair to say that most people in the state of Alaska wanted to bring that line all the way through Alaska. They didn't want the line to go into Canada. A line within Alaska, of course, would assure that we got most of the jobs, which indeed we did. And it also assured a much higher level of control over the line than we would have had if the line had gone through Canada. I think there was a pretty fair debate about the merits of the various schemes, and it's my recollection that the line through Canada basically just did not muster the support either in the Congress or in the state of Alaska.
We have another caller right now who is coming to us from Fairbanks. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I
am. What's your question?
We've all seen up here the barrage of lawsuits that came down against all the oil companies in Alyeska even prior to this spill, and we can assume that they won't comply with anything if they can find a way to save money. So I'm looking at the citizen watchdog committees, like what they have in the North Sea, and how effective they can be as a whistleblowing organization. And looking at compartmentalized tankers and decent hours for the crewmen and things like that, as who can't blow the whistle on them when they do their traditional American corporate behavior.
Caller, do you who are you addressing your question to? Is this to the governor?
Senator Murkowski and Stevens had some interesting material in the mail here last month about mm-hmm. citizen watchdog.
Yeah, there are really two parts of this question that might be addressed to our two new guests. BP Exploration, of course, is the biggest owner of the Alyeska Pipeline Company, and there's an allegation here that Alyeska will do whatever it can get away with. Can you just we need a chance to, for you to introduce yourself, Mr. Herrera, and respond to that.
Well, actually, my field of interest in, and I suppose expertise in Alaska is concerned with exploration production, not with transportation. I certainly have nothing whatsoever to do with the running of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline or the tankerage out of Valdez. I mean, the reason I'm here, of course, is because that accident does have implications on future development in the state of Alaska onshore. But just as a general comment, the suggestion that major oil companies in Alaska do not have safety and the protection of the environment uppermost in their minds, I think is clearly not correct. The one thing that we concentrate on these days is exactly that, safety of people and protection of the environment.
Mr. Herrera, perhaps one thing you could enlighten us with is some information on what's happening in the rest of the industry. The response, what kind of response has the industry had to the oil spill?
Well, clearly the oil spill has impacted every operational oil company in the land, especially those of us in Alaska. And we have been analyzing it very carefully, not only to see direct lessons from it with regard to improvements in safety in the transportation mode, but also indirect ones. How can we improve our safety overall in the exploration field, for example, in production, with regard to oil spills and total operations? So not only those direct lessons have been learned from this effort or are being learned, but also, of course, there have been other fallouts, such as the sort of political impacts which have resulted from the spill, which have affected us all.
We do have questions about the political impacts, especially as they extend to other potential areas of exploration and discovery, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We have a caller right now whose questions may be able to speak to that. It's a call from Barrow, Arnold Brower. Are you with us, Mr. Brower?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, just fine. You're on the air with Roger Herrera, Governor Steve Cooper, and Oil Spill Commission Chairman Walt Parker.
So I just want to make a couple of statements in relation to the oil spills. And since the state has the 3 mile territory of waters all across Alaska, and being a state managing navigable waters, and there's villages and cities, incorporated cities throughout the coastline, and there should not be some form of prudent management, maybe every 100 miles or 100, 200 miles, that certain contingency plans should be perhaps worked into the villages or train the coastal areas to, because you have these oil tankers that will be coming off the Arctic coast or going down, or the fuel haul tankers, and you don't anticipate any spills, but they happen without reason sometimes. And I think it would be a proof of the state to maybe to consider that.
Let me ask you to hold that. We do want to talk to that. Right now, we have Governor Steve Cooper on the line. We'd like to thank him for his participation. We have to move along, but we'll be right back. This is the Alaska Oil Spill, a nationwide call.
This program is made possible by Alaska Public Radio member stations, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, and individual contributions to APRN's Disaster Coverage Fund. The toll-free line, courtesy of Alascom.
Seems like Mr. Brower's question is really for you about offshore safety. Governor Cooper, are you with us?
Sure. Sure I am. The question of whether or not wells can be drilled offshore or not really is one that you can only answer with respect to one specific proposal, because the way in which offshore drilling is done in the Arctic is different in every instance. That's why the state has to look at every proposal to drill offshore in a different way. There's no package of things that covers everybody up there. The drilling that has been proposed off the Beaufort so far is drilling that will take place when the ice is solid there. Once the ice breaks up and there's broken ice in the water, we don't want people drilling. There's too much of a potential for an accident there. And I think also it's correct to say that particularly after what happened in the Santa Barbara Channel in 1969, offshore platforms have been required to have in place the best available technology. I think that the potential for a spill in an offshore platform has been reduced dramatically since those days. Although, of course, in fairness, when people think of offshore drilling, that's the incident that they think about. But I think that the methodology that's been developed specifically for the Arctic and for the Chukchi as well is much more extensive than it was back in those days. So it's a call that we have to make with respect to every request for a permit to drill in the Arctic.
Arnold Brower, are you still on with us? Does that speak
to
the question?
If I might add one more comment in relation to what Senator Stevens just alluded to, that we prohibited offshore drilling, but perhaps maybe a different way to add maybe into the bill or someplace is to make it attractive so that if there are non-commercial quantities of oil are found on land, that the municipalities, the affected communities have the residual rights. For instance, in Barrow alone, the non-commercial quantity of oil, if we find the technology to refine it, I mean, that's going to take Barrow in its self-sufficiency of oil for a long way. So I think we need to maybe perhaps introduce similar language that have attractive language into the bills.
Thank you. Our thanks, too, now to Governor Steve Cooper. We really appreciate your time, Governor.
Well, I appreciate your airing this program. I think it has a lot of value to the people in this state as well as the nation. Thank you.
And we'd like to turn right now to Walt Parker, who's the chairman of the Alaska Oil Spill Commission. Walt, what kind of case is the commission trying to build right now following up on the oil spill?
Our primary emphasis right from our first meeting is on prevention. By prevention, we mean up to the point where oil enters the water. Once the ship is grounded or had a collision, we regard it as a system failure. So what's on the other side of that is where we're going to address a good many, in fact, hopefully the greater part of our efforts. We have the seven shippers from Valdez and the owners of the Alyeska in to a meeting 2 weeks ago. It was a very good meeting. The point the earlier caller made on double bottoms, which we've discussed at length here today because I've been listening, had no resolution. There are severe economic penalties for the shippers, which they pointed out in going to double bottoms or double hulls, and amounting to only being able to carry 65% of the amount of oil, according to one of the owners. And our naval architect consultant somewhat disagree with that, but the National Academy of Sciences also has a subcommittee working on this,
and hopefully will shed a great deal of light on double bottoms and double hulls before we're through. The thing that was most attractive to me in our meeting with the owners was the fact that they are seriously thinking of upgrading their operational standards for their crews generally, and to really concentrate on trying to move away from some of the archaic marine traditions which have governed their operations in the past, and having the crews more closely match the highly automated ships that they're operating now. And that was a very good discussion, and one that will be putting a great deal of our concentration in working with the industry, the Coast Guard, and everybody else in the marine world to substantially upgrade. Because the difference between now and the old days in the marine world is we're carrying a great deal of hazardous cargo and of oil, which is not classified as hazardous in the marine environment. And the whole shipping industry has got to recognize that. One of the most hopeful things is getting people to really adhere to their traffic lanes. If the Exxon Valdez had stayed in the traffic lane, as was agreed on in 1977 when we opened the terminal, obviously the incident would not have happened.